Council now come to order. It's 3:15 on March 28th. With us, we have Representative Dew, Representative Tilton, Representative Hughes, Representative Josephson, Representative Tito, and myself, Chair Olson. We do have a quorum and conduct business. First up is House Bill 308, Child Safety Seat Installation Liability. To present the bill, we have the sponsor, Representative Sharice Millett, and her staff, Lindsay...
Witt.
W-I-T-T?
W-H-I-T-T, Lindsay Witt.
Oh, close enough. Thank you for joining us today, and for the record, please read yourself onto the records, and you have our undivided attention.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Sharice Millett, House District Representative from District 25 in the beautiful city of Anchorage, and with me I have my staff, Lindsay Witt, and this is her first bill presentation, so I expect...
You want us to go gentle?
Let's go gentle. Thank you, Chairman Olson and members of the committee for hearing HB 308 today. I appreciate you hearing this. This bill limits the liability for those folks that volunteer to install car seats properly for those folks that have children. Most of you, I can remember growing up when I had my first baby, I'm going to date myself, child car safety seats were suggested, not enforced by law, but we have seen since they became law and that folks have to have a car seat for their infants and their toddlers that we've seen a decline in deaths and reduced injuries to those kids, and keeping kids safe is a really important issue for me. Right now, as it stands, we have folks that inspect child safety seats throughout the state of Alaska, about 200 of those folks in their capacity, whether it's part of their jobs at the fire station, at the police force, at a hospital. Those folks are offered the ability to have be limited in their liability through their employer. This bill seeks to aim to help folks that are volunteering on a volunteer basis at a community gathering, at a child safety seat installation, so folks that don't have the opportunity to go to a fire station or a police station, or folks that live in rural Alaska that don't have the opportunity to go to those because they don't have those. The ability to use a child safety technician, child passenger safety inspector technician in their communities to do it without the fear of liability. Lindsay's going to walk you through the sectional. There's hours of training that go into this technician job. It's a really a great job, and it's a great thing to have in your community. It keeps our kids safe. It keeps parents comfortable when they car seats are big. Car seats are hard to install, not knowing how to get them in. I have two grandkids, Mr. Chairman, and I was just home on Easter and tried to install two of their car seats in my car, and I was left very frustrated. So I imagine what a new mother is going through when you're worried about all sorts of issues with your newborn, that this is one thing I think we can take off their plate by allowing folks in communities to help new parents install and correctly install. We've seen it save lives. We recently had an incident in the state. I think it was pretty highly profiled of a child that was in an accident and came out of its child safety seat. Even though it was installed correctly, it saved its life. Child safety seats are impressive things. I'm glad we have them, and this bill is just advocating for more folks to have kids in their cars in a safer environment and installed correctly, and making sure that those people that volunteer to do that have the opportunity to do that without the fear of being sued, basically. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I will send it over to Lindsay to do the sectional on it, and if you have any questions, she is... I've been studying for a couple weeks now on this piece of legislation, and I'm proud to have her here with me. So,
thank you for joining us today. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and you have our undivided attention.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Lindsay Witt, and I'm staff to Representative Millett. And if you'd like, I'll just walk through the sectional analysis quickly. So Section 1 reads that provides that the following are not civilly liable in the case of an act or omission that occurs in the inspection, installation, or adjustment of a child safety seat, or in providing education regarding the installation of an adjustment of the child safety seat. A certified Child Passenger Safety Technician, we often call and might be referred to in your packet as CPST, or an instructor, a person who arranges or offers the services of a CPST for the community, a person who owns property where the technician is operating. A technician must offer their services for free to be covered under this bill, and for the amount of, or for the amount of their actual costs in good faith and within the scope of their training. They may also not be sponsored by a child passenger safety device manufacturer or retailer. And the Section 2 simply is the applicability clause that enacted by Section 1. This act applies to the causes of action that accrue on or after the effective date of this bill. Can I offer any answers to questions that you may have?
So this would cover firefighters and EMTs that have received training, because basically that's on the Kenai Peninsula. The three major departments all do this, and it's pretty much on a walk-in basis, not scheduled for any particular day or weekend. They'll take people anytime they come in, as long as they're not out on a call.
That's correct.
So they're covered.
So through the chair, Mr. Just for a clarification, so they're already covered by their employer. This would be if they volunteered outside of their fire station or police house. That would be if they had a child safety weekend and they could volunteer their time outside of the firehouse or the police station.
I think on occasion they take it to schools.
Right, So that's what they would be covered under.
Home builder show, whatever.
Right.
Representative Liddell.
What do you mean they're already covered by their employer?
So through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the liability is covered through the municipality that they work for, but they still have to be certified. I mean, they're limited liability through their employer. This is offering the limited liability outside of their employment, so when they're volunteering their own behalf, not representing the municipality or representing their private employer.
Follow?
So if they're representing their employer, is it actually limited liability, or they're simply insurance through their employer?
Through the chair, I believe it's through insurance through their employer. And so this would be if they were outside. Let's just say I wanted to go out and get my certificate to do this. I work for the state of Alaska, but I would be going out and doing it on a volunteer basis. I go through the training, I get the certificate, I'm certificated, I go out and I say, I want to help your grandchild put in their car seat, and I'm a technician. That would limit the liability that I would have if something failed in that car seat or the installation of that car seat.
Paula?
Wouldn't just about everybody be covered by insurance through their homeowner's insurance? I mean, it's amazing actually what homeowner's insurance actually does cover. So I guess I'm kind of wondering whether or not was it the insurance companies that has asked for this bill, or has it been the people who put this stuff in?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, it's actually off-duty police officers and firefighters that would like to offer this service, but because that they could be civilly sued, they're certificated, they wanted to be covered with basically a Good Samaritan law that waives civil liability for them if they install their car seats.
And are they aware, really, that homeowners insurance actually would probably pay for this if...
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, not all people own homes.
And probably was the key word in that. And I'd like to reflect we've been joined by Representative Culver. Representative Hughes.
Thank you for bringing this bill forward. And it's not really a particular question about the bill. It's just I'm wondering, because I remember struggling with installing car seats like you have, and I still struggle. In fact, even getting a child buckled in once they're installed can be tricky, and you need a course in that. But when new parents leave a hospital, is there any kind of program that's really aimed to make sure that very initial ride in a car seat, that the seat's installed, or would the parent have to take the initiative to go to the fire station or the police department and get some assistance, or is there anything that is targeted to brand new parents leaving the hospital?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, that's a great question. I believe when I my daughter left the Native Hospital, they actually came out. They had a certified person that came out and installed it, but I'm not sure that's in every case, but my staff here could probably tell you the answer to that.
Well, through the chair, Representative Hughes, staff for Rep. Millett, I would recommend to that parent that they contact someone in their area before the baby is born, and they can have the class from the technician and learn how to install the baby safely without the anxiety of being a new parent. But as I've called all throughout the state, everyone is more than willing to stop by the hospital or meet you at a location or meet you at the firehouse to show you how to do this properly. So we have over 200 technicians throughout the state, and I think anyone could call one of the numbers provided and receive service.
Follow up?
Certainly.
And I would guess the people that are wanting this bill and that really care about, especially after the incident we heard about in the news lately, that they're taking the initiative perhaps to contact the hospitals, or at least I'd hope that they would, and make sure that service is known and available to parents at that important time. Because I think that parent is a little bit preoccupied, and then when coming out to their car and realizing, oh my goodness, I'm going to put this precious bundle in the seat, that's not the time to be worrying about whether it's installed properly. So thank you.
To the chair. And just to that point, through the chair, Representative Hughes, and I'll be sure and we'll call the hospitals and see if they do have some type of awareness or some type of conversation that they have with new parents when they leave the maternity ward, or if in the case of adoption or someone, a grandparent is taking care, there's opportunity for them to know that this is out there, this service is out there. Because it is, you're right, it's a really important service, and we all want safe kids, and we want, them transported safely. So,
in a few minutes when we get into the public testimony, I think that will be answered sufficiently. Representative Ledoux.
So I'm just trying to follow this. The person has had to successfully complete this National Child Passenger Safety Certification Program. That's the first thing. Mm-hmm. And then B and C is an either or. They either have to offer or arrange a nonprofit child safety seat educational program, or, and this is what I don't understand, own property where a nonprofit child safety seat educational program, checkup, event, etc. I don't understand that section.
Through the chair, we have Liz Legal on. They can probably explain the wording on that, because sometimes I'm a little confused on why they word things the way they do. But what the bill is getting at is for those folks that aren't working in a police station, or aren't working at Providence, or aren't working at some establishment where that is part of their service that they provide, will have limited liability when they go outside of their employment, or if they are just personally interested in child car seat safety.
But they've had to... Through the chair. Okay. There are three things. Mm-hmm. 1A, mm-hmm. either 1B or 1C, and then 2. So maybe could I talk to Legislative Legal?
In a few minutes.
Okay.
Thanks, Gabriel.
Any further questions? With that, thank you, and...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're taking off.
I am going to be leaving. I apologize, but Lindsay's going to stay with you for more questions.
And with that, we'll open up public testimony, and... Jane Fellman, Safe Kids, Soldotna. You with us, Jane?
Yes, I am. I'm in Kenai right now.
And I've got a feeling what your testimony is going to be, but thank you for joining us today, and please state your name and affiliation for the record, and you've got our undivided attention.
Thank you. My name is Jane Fellman. I'm a registered nurse at Central Peninsula Hospital, and I'm the coordinator for the Kenai Peninsula Safe Kids Coalition, and I have been a child passenger safety technician since 1998 and an instructor since 2000. And two. So we have spent many years assisting and educating and helping parents be able to get over all these hurdles that some of them that you already discussed, with the challenges of properly placing their child in a car seat for the proper age and weight. And it is overwhelming, and it's continually changing because everything's being driven, and we are they're finding safer and safer ways to keep our children safer, as well as us in our motor vehicles. So So it's not something that's always easy. It's not something that we have been, just because you did it a certain way 5 years ago, that it doesn't change and things, you have to adjust to that. So what child passenger safety technicians do is they are the resource for the parents. They go out and we check or inspect the child in the seat to make sure the seat is the correct seat for that child, and then we check for the proper installation. And then we educate the parent on what the misuses are, as well as helping assist and teach them how to prevent those, to correct those misuses. So some of the information that we have, we look at misuses, and nationwide it's about 46%, but our numbers in the state of Alaska show that the misuses rates of the seats that we actually see and check is about 85%. So we know that that technicians are needed to be able to help navigate the system for the family and educate them. So we're asking that in order to keep technicians and have more of them, we want to be able to have those people that are very passionate about it, who are not employed by an agency, or they come to a community car seat check out of their own time. We want to provide some more level of protection for them. So I really encourage you to support this bill.
Thank you very much, Jane. Don Etheridge, come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Labor Commerce Committee. I'm Don Etheridge with the AFL-CIO, and we're supportive of this bill because it's a lot of our membership that goes out and does this training in their off hours. That's what they do. They volunteer all the time. And as far as the hospital here is, once you check in and say that you're going to have a baby and start all the preliminary stuff, they send you out to the police department to make sure that you have a car seat and that you know how to use it. And if you don't have one, the police department here will give you a car seat just to make sure that your child is safe. And we've had personal experience with a family friend that didn't know how to install a car seat, and she would use, instead of being able to do it right, she'd tie a knot in the buckles instead of using them right. And so we taught her how to do it, and 2 days later she totaled her car, and the baby would have been killed had that not been done right. So we're still fully supportive of this piece of legislation.
Thank you. Any questions for Don? Thanks again, Don. Clinton Powell, AFD, are you with us?
I'm with you. Thank you for having me, Chairman.
Thank you for joining us, and please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Clinton Powell. I'm a senior captain with the Anchorage Fire Department.
And did you have a prepared statement or just supportive?
I'm just here in support of the bill. I want to mention that we on the Anchorage Fire Department have been, I head up our child safety seat inspection program. We check close to 400 seats every year. And while this is a Anchorage Fire Department program, we have outreach throughout the state. In fact, we have two of our instructors who have been given an award by the Governor's Alaska Council on EMS as the 2014 EMS Educators of the Year for their work in communities outside of Anchorage, Kodiak and Ketchikan, to name a couple. So we want partners in these communities which may not have the insurance coverage by being on duty with the Anchorage Fire Department that we enjoy. So I view this as being a statewide benefit to educators across the state.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. We do have Sarah Penston from Providence online for questions, if anybody has any questions for Sarah. Representative Hughes.
Yes, thank you for being online and available. Maybe you heard the questions earlier about coordination with the hospitals when new babies are born and leaving the hospital. Can you speak to that at Providence?
I certainly can. Thank you for the opportunity, and thank you, Chairman Olson, for hearing this bill today for our group. Here at
Could you please state your name and affiliation for the record?
Oh, my name, I'm sorry, is Sarah Penniston. I'm a registered nurse at Providence Alaska Medical Center, and the Safe Kids Alaska State Coalition Coordinator. I've been a child passenger safety technician since 1999 and an instructor since 2006. And in response to the question regarding hospital policies and protocols, what I can tell you at Providence is that every newborn leaving Providence here in Anchorage does have their car seat checked for recall status, appropriate fit, and expiration date of that car seat, because they do expire. And if parents request to have assistance in their vehicle, we do have a number of certified child passenger safety technicians on staff, including myself, that can assist them. We also have folks who are special, who have had special training for children with unique transportation needs, such as in a cast or special positioning needs, because we have unique car seats to assist those children and their families. However, those policies and procedures are not required of hospitals that deliver babies or offer pediatric services. So every hospital in our state has a different policy, or perhaps does not have a policy at all, regarding what they do with car seats for their pediatric patients and their newborns. So that is not a standardized program. Not every hospital in our state has certified technicians. And in many cases, when we have reached out to those entities, encouraging them to get people trained and have protocols in place, they have stated to us the reason we do not check car seats at our hospital is because we fear the liability involved. The bill before you would actually take that liability issue away, because the fact that folks have successfully completed the certification and hold the certification would release them from that additional liability. And please understand that obtaining the certification is not a situation where you go to a two-hour class and you get a certificate. This is a three-day nationally standardized course. It involves skills evaluations, written examinations, and attending and participating in a public checkup event. I believe Representative Ledoux had some questions about sections A, B, and C of the bill language. I would just like to address that section B specifically addresses folks who are working to arrange public checkup events for car seats, not necessarily the technician themselves. And section C specifically addresses the property owner. We are frequently asked from child care centers, elementary schools, or other agencies to host checkup events on their property. This bill would also excuse those property owners from any additional liability. So I hope that helps clarify the questions that Representative Ledoux had.
She's nodding her head, yes. Representative Hughes.
Yes, thank you, Sarah. I'm looking at the bill. So if it's a nonprofit, but for arranging on a nonprofit program or on a property for a nonprofit program, it would cover them. But what if a for-profit hospital offered this service? Would be liable, wouldn't they?
Excellent question. Thank you for letting me elaborate on that. It actually, this status of the entity or property owner is not what is clarified as the nonprofit. It's the actual event. So the nonprofit child safety seat education program checkup event or checking station. So what that means is that we are not charging a fee for people to attend the educational offering or the car seat checkup event. I hope that clarified that question.
Well, now I'm thinking back to when you described in your initial testimony that at your hospital that you have certified technicians and that they do check the car seat itself to make sure it's not expired, but they would only assist with the installation if it's requested by a parent. So then you have a hospital employee, I'm assuming, going out to the vehicle and either helping install or checking the installation. And you're a non-profit hospital. Some are for-profit. So I'm wondering about if a hospital employee goes out and assists with the installation, the liability insurance would be through the hospital, wouldn't it? They wouldn't be relieved of that through this bill, is my understanding.
If they would, my understanding is that if you are acting within the scope of your employment, then your employer's insurance is primary. And what this bill specifically is addressing is when we have certified technicians who are not working in a technician status for their employer, such as if there is a firefighter who is a certified child passenger safety technician, and in their off-duty hours, they volunteer for a public car seat checkup event being held at a child care center. At that point, they are not representing their employer because they're not on duty. And so they are then volunteering at the event.
Representative Hughes?
Yes, and I understood. Thank you, Sarah. But I was thinking more in reference to your comments that your hospital provides that to new parents. So every day there are new parents leaving the hospital with a baby, and any day, several times a day, a parent could be requesting assistance, and then you'd have a hospital employee helping with that. And I'm just curious, and one final question related to that, Mr. Chair, is that your hospital has the policy that the car seat itself is checked to make sure it's appropriate for the size, weight of the child, that it's not expired. Are the parents bringing those in, or is the hospital person going out to the vehicle to see that they're installed correctly?
I'm here at Providence in Anchorage. Our protocol is that the car seat needs to be brought into the unit for the newborn, and that is where we check for recalls, expiration status. Every staff member involved in that process goes through a 3-hour training class here at our hospital, and those are all documented in the medical chart, as well as it is a standing hospital policy and protocol, how we conduct our patient care here.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Any further questions for Sarah? Thanks again for joining us today, Sarah. For questions only, we have Megan Wallace, Mari Carpinetti, and Susan Cox from the Department of Law, if anybody has any legal questions online. Seeing none, we have Anthony Green for question only, who is the Director of Public Policy for Safe Kids in Washington. Representative Hughes.
Mr. Chair, I think this might be for either Lindsay or the Department of Law. May I ask the question?
Fire it at Lindsay. And we'll see.
I'll fire it at Lindsay, because I was just wondering if there are any current or past civil lawsuits against technicians in the state of Alaska related to installation of car seats.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, Lindsay Witt, no. We have no existing lawsuits for technicians in the state of Alaska. This is for future liability.
And then follow up. Are you aware, has this been a problem other parts of the country?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, I am aware that there is one case outside of Alaska within the United States. However, the great issue at hand is retention and recruiting people who are, out of the goodness of their heart, offering to teach people about car seats, which in Alaska, 85% of the reviewed ones last year were wrong. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to help the firefighters and the hospitals and the police departments recruit people who care enough to install car seats correctly. So no cases inside in Alaska.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thanks again. And Anthony Green, are you with us?
I am. I am, sir.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record. And did you catch the last question on the out-of-state litigation?
I did, sir. Anthony Green, Safe Kids Worldwide. I'm the Director of Public Policy. I am aware of just one incident. It did not rise to the level of a lawsuit, and it was many years ago, where a parent had an issue having to do with a car seat inspection. That was the only incident that we know about, and we're the ones that are responsible for the training of the child passenger safety technicians, and the due diligence, as Sarah noted, is very strong.
Do you have any additional thoughts on House Bill 308 as currently drafted?
Well, I'm just very supportive of it, and very supportive of the idea of providing this level of comfort to volunteers, many of them, most of them volunteers, who would perform this very important thing for parents. In the United States, 94% of cars that have been inspected by NHTSA have had car seats in them. But then, on the other hand, 46% of them are incorrectly used. And they're not very useful when they're incorrectly used. And that's where the child passenger safety technicians, their events, and their programs take hold, and why they're so important.
Any further questions?
Actually,
Representative Hughes.
I am curious about this. I love children. I want them as safe as possible. The last gentleman just spoke about a 56% rate of the car seats not being installed correctly. And Lindsay, I think you said 85. Why the difference in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, Lindsay Witt. So the amount that he referenced, 56, I believe, is for the United States. I was speaking specifically to Alaska. In 2014, the amount of car seats that were reviewed, we had 85% of them incorrect. So I don't have the direct stats. Sarah Penniston online might be able to speak more to that, but the numbers that I quoted were for the state of Alaska.
Follow-up. Yeah, I understood the difference in numbers. I was wondering why the rate is so much worse in Alaska. Do you have any understanding why that might be?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, I do not. It's a great question.
But we might have somebody that does know. Corliss Taylor, Fairbanks Hospital Child Seat Inspector, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and how about it?
Okay, my name is Corliss Taylor. I'm the Education Department Director for Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, and I am a child passenger safety technician and also an instructor. So I've been involved in child passenger safety for more than 20 years here in Alaska, and I support this bill. As an instructor, I've trained a number of people in the Fairbanks community who participate as volunteers in events that we sponsor around the city to check car seats for the community at large. And it's correct, 85% of the seats that come, of the people that come to our events, looking back through our paperwork, 85% come to us installed incorrectly. And in some events that we have, we might check 20 cars and all of the seats have some problem with how they've been installed. And so we're about educating parents on how to correctly install those seats and to transport their children safely. We also have a program, of course, as a hospital to work with families with children with disabilities and special needs to help them transport their children safely. So I'm in support of this bill because of the people that we ask in our community that have been trained as technicians to come to events and to assure them that they have some sort of coverage for liability for participating in those events.
Representative Hughes, do you have a question?
Well, I did, and it hasn't been answered, so I don't know if she's able to answer it as why the rate in Alaska is essentially double what it is in the lower 48 for incorrect installation.
I have some suppositions about that. Initially, when we started with the Child Passenger Safety Program through NHTSA nationwide, the nationwide average was between 85 and 95% when we first started. I think there's been a huge decline in the lower 48 because they've had the advantage in many states of having a higher number of technicians and, you know, more advertisement, PR, et cetera, for communicating to the public what changes they need to make in order to have their car seat safely. Here in Alaska, as you know, we, our message needs to get spread far and wide, and we have not had the funds to be able to do that and, you know, to spread that message out far and wide. And so I think that that's part of the issue, is just education and reaching parents. And so over the last probably 5 or 6 years, we're really working hard to reach more and more parents and in the state with regard to what they need to do. And so that's the big difference, I think.
Well, thank you for what you do, and I think that it just speaks to the fact that this bill needs to pass so that we will have more certified technicians and so that we can change those rates here in Alaska. Thank you.
Any further questions? Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify that hasn't had the opportunity? Seeing none, is there anybody online? Hearing none, we will close out public testimony and bring the bill back to committee for discussion. Any discussion? What are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I move HB 308 version 29-LS1323/A from committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Is there any opposition to moving the bill out of committee? The bill is moved on to judiciary, and with that, we'll take a brief at ease. For months. Presenting, it'll be Lori Wang-Heyer, the Director of the Division of Insurance, and welcome back, and go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Lori Wang-Heyer. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. Before you, you have House Bill 372, which is the Omnibus Insurance Bill for the Division of Insurance. This bill resolves several things for the Division of Insurance this year, including key federal preemptions brought about by the Affordable Care Act. It also provides modernization and updates to several chapters of Title 21. It amends the cost of market conduct examinations. It addresses modernized record-keeping requirements. It further requires a designation of only one compliance officer for each class of authority written by an insurance firm. It clarifies that continuing education providers also are subject to continuing education requirements. It modernizes certain sections of Title 21 pertaining to licensing. It clarifies certain provisions regarding payment of fees due for transacting insurance. It clarifies when a person may not sell insurance as an inducement to join an association or become a member of a labor union. It also amends parts dealing with fraud and criminal fraud and associated fines and penalties. In addition, this bill will provide filing efficiency in the elimination of requirements that each filing form include the year of adoption. It allows for endorsements in addition to the original policy to be posted on the insurer's websites for all lines of insurance. It clarifies the value of a variable life or a variable annuity refund. And it modernizes certain sections of Title 21 related to group life insurance issued to a bona fide association as defined. With that, I'd be happy to go through the bill's sectional analysis to give the members a detailed view of what this bill does.
That'd be fine, but I'd like to add that the bill started out at 108 pages, so this is the slim version of the bill. But please continue.
Okay. Section 1. This is somewhat of a cleanup, and this is amended only to the fact that we are formally taking the term examiner's handbook is now, let me correct myself, formerly the term examiner's handbook is now part of market regulation handbook, and we have corrected that in the bill so that we are now compliant with the NAIC.
And for those in the room that don't know what NAIC is?
The National Association of Insurance Commissioners. My apologies. The second section, conduct of examination. And again, we're talking the National Association. And again, this is just an update on the term examiner's handbook to market regulation handbook. Section 3, this was a call on the Division of Insurance, and this has to go with our ability to go in and examine managing general agents, third-party administrators, reinsurance intermediary managers, motor vehicle service contract providers, and surplus lines brokers from the requirement of paying of division personnel and overhead costs relating to an examination. As you know, the Division of Insurance has the ability to, in 2106, to charge our fees back. But because of the cost of our examinations of these local Alaskan-owned managing general agents in particular, the cost was so high we had quit doing the examinations. Some of these managing general agents were three-person shops, and we were billing them back $23,000 to go and do an examination. This provision will allow us to go in and do an examination and only charge such as our additional costs, such as the travel, but not bill back the hourly expenses of the division, which they are already paying for in licensing. So we will.
Mm-hmm. Representative Joseph.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Winghart, can you describe on the ground what you've just said? That is, this 20 to what's happening? Paint me a picture of the $21,000 to $23,000 expense.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. The Division of Insurance will go into a brokerage firm and look at their books to see that they're in compliance with Title 21. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, then we bill back the brokerage firm, the managing general agent, much like we bill back an insurance company. We bill them back for our expenses. Some of the managing general agents and the agents that we're listing here, the third-party administrators, reinsurance administrators, motor vehicle service contract providers, are very small shops. And these are owned independent businesses in the state of Alaska. And by the time we send a team of two people in for a week or more, we add the expense of a travel to Anchorage or Fairbanks from Juneau, the time of a 37.5-hour week for these people, the per diem, and then the cost to write the report, send it back out. The estimated cost for these exams was more than this firm was making in a year. So we quit doing the examinations. So it was basically defeating the purpose of having this, the ability to go in and audit or examine to see that they were in compliance. So what we're suggesting is, since these managing general agents and such are already paying the division on licensure, that we bill back for our overhead or out-of-pocket expenses, but not for the benefits and the salary of the division personnel, so that we can go in and see that these agencies are in compliance.
Now, Director, that wouldn't preclude you from going in if you thought there was either illegal or something really egregious going on. You could go in immediately, I would assume.
Mr. Chairman, that is absolutely right.
So you're talking about routine mm-hmm. examinations?
Okay.
Follow-up?
No, I mean, it begs the question about lost revenue for the state. It sounds incredibly egregious, but it begs those sort of questions, but beyond that, I don't have any.
Through the chair, these firms are already licensed with the division, so they're already paying a license to support the division.
Right.
And so in looking at this, if they're paying the out-of-pocket and paying the licensure, we feel we're recouping the cost. Section 4 is utilization review and benefit determination, grievance procedures, and external review. This is probably a key component of this bill. This takes us out from federal preemption and puts us in compliance with the Affordable Care Act. This is going to be a large regulation project for us. We are repealing certain sections of Title 21 and we'll put it into regulation, but it will put us out in compliance with the Affordable Care Act as far as utilization review, and it's very defined in three model laws of the NAIC as to benefit determination and appeals process and an internal and external review process.
On that point,
President Jones.
Thank you. So, through the chair, Ms. Winghart, the threat of federal preemption was that we weren't doing utilization review, or what?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the state has been doing the external review, mm-hmm. but we have been doing it under the federal law, okay. not our own state.
Okay. Thank you.
Section 5 deals with, is amended to require that a health care provider disclose to the patient its transparency, what part of the preferred provider agreement that the health care provider has signed with the insurance company, declare to the patient what they can expect to receive back or how much will be paid of the service that that patient is going to have performed prior to that service being performed. So it's transparency between the patient and the provider. Section 6 is required contract provisions for the health care insurance policy. And this is again putting in federal compliance. Section 7.
And, Mr. Chair, I know we have another bill as well, but if I may, real fast.
Sure.
I noticed a lot of repealed language in Section 6. What are we giving up there? The appeal process related to utilization review.
To the Chair, Representative Josephson, there is quite a bit that we're repealing because we're going to put that into reg. We're going to put the model laws into a regulation project.
Okay. Thank you.
Section 7 is amending a health care insurer to permit a covered person to designate a pediatrician where the health care insurer offers a health care policy that requires or provides for a designation by the covered person. Section 8 is amended to recognize an exception to the subscriber's requirement, and this is due again to the new Section H. Section 9. Section 9, and this is the Section 8, prohibits a healthcare insurer that offers a healthcare insurance policy that provides for OBGYN that requires designation by a covered person of a participating primary care from requiring authorization or referral for a female patient to receive OBGYN care from a participating provider. Section 10 repeals and reenacts to define emergency services to mean medical care services or items furnished or required to evaluate and treat an emergency medical condition. Section 11 defines utilization review. Section 12 defines emergency medical conditions. Section 13 amends maintenance records, and that's an update to comply with the domicile of the jurisdictions of the state where the insurer is domiciled. Section 14, again, has to do with records maintenance of the insured and the domicile where the insured is domiciled. Section 15 is an update on wet marine, and transportation insurance by providing a definition. And this is also correcting a drafting error that was in Section 15. Section 16 provides general qualifications for a license, and this is a non-substantive drafting change. Section 17 is amended for general qualifications for licensing. And this is where we make it clear that continuing education providers are subject to the continuing education requirements of the state. Section 18 has to do with the compliance officers. Section 19 adds crop insurance to limited producer license. And that takes up about three pages of the bill. Section 20 is amended to make non-substantive changes to conform to the language of the state-based system. We refer to it as SBS, and it's the data or the software system that we use, supported by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. And it's used by state regulators to support the insurance regulatory functions. And this is just amended to comply with that software system.
Are both states using the same program?
Yes, sir, they are. Section 21 is basic, and 22 are basically the same thing, to conform with SBS, or the state-based system of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. Section 23 is qualifications for a third-party administrator. As is Section 24. Section 25 has to do with the operating requirements for reinsurance, intermediary brokers, and actions for loss. Section 26 is a technical correction. Section 27 is listing of eligible surplus lines insurance, and this is to comply with the Federal Non-Admitted and Reinsurance Reform Act of 2010. We're basically deleting this because, I shouldn't say we're deleting it. The division has not been charging this fee since 2011 due to this federal law. Section 28 is amended to remove references to fees charged to eligible non-admitted insurers. That's where we are deleting it, because we have not collected it. Section 29 is amended to add home state to the subsection, again, to be compliant with the NRRA, or the National Non-Admitted and Reinsurance Reform Act of 2010. Section 30 is unfair marketing practices prohibited, and this is where I spoke of, you cannot sell a membership in a union or an association simply to qualify someone for insurance. Section 31 is based on Model 72 of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and its compliance of healthcare grievance reporting and record keeping requirements.
Representative Hughes, followed by Representative Keto.
I'm sorry, Ms. Gabrielle.
Oh, Gabrielle. Representative Ledoux.
Section 30. So does that happen very often? I mean, and I'm not exactly sure what's so awful about it if it did happen.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we have on the books what we call a fictitious group.
Perfect.
And it's, you can't form a group solely for the purposes of selling insurance. Now, you can have a group, and as a part of that group, then they can offer an insurance product. But you can't form a group such as, let's just pick the NRA. They have a group life insurance product.
mm-hmm.
or health product. But their main focus is not that insurance product. And if they ask you to become a member, it's their purpose is not to sell you that insurance policy. Well, and the same for a union or any other association, be it broadcasters. There's several associations in the state.
Okay, so for example, I'm a member of Sons of Norway, and I know Sons of Norway has insurance policies. Mm-hmm. Couldn't a salesman from the Sons of Norway Insurance Association come to, well, not me, because I'm already a member, but come to Representative Tilton or Representative Olson and say, you know, we have this phenomenal insurance policy, and you've got to be a member of Sons of Norway in order to get this phenomenal policy, but the cost of membership is relatively slight, and then you're eligible for that. What would be so awful if that happened?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, to begin with, and I'm going to go back a bit here, the ACA has taken a very tough stance on associations.
The
Affordable Care Act has taken a very tough stance on associations. And basically because they want them in either the group or the individual market. So we are trying to, we do not particularly want to see the associations that are already in Alaska be disbanded. And this bill addresses that in a couple different places where we talk about bona fide associations. However, we do say that you cannot form an association solely for the purpose of selling insurance, nor should someone solicit you to the group solely for the purpose of selling insurance, because there is compliance with the Affordable Care Act that we have to meet.
But the Fictitious Group Act has been on the
books
forever.
The fictitious group statute has been there forever.
I'm still confused. What does this have to do with, I mean, the Affordable Care Act, this provision here? This isn't, I mean, I'm not talking about a fictitious group. I'm talking about a scenario which is just like I described it.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, and I understand that, I do. But to keep the Sons of Norway, in your example, out of trouble, their first offer to you should not be, we have an insurance product. Their first offer should be, we're a great organization, and we have all these benefits, including an insurance product. And that's okay, but not we have an insurance product, and then we are the Sons of Norway.
To me, it just seems like a difference in style, almost.
They're not licensed as an insurance company to sell insurance.
Follow?
And so does the Affordable Care Act, is it down on associations, even those that don't sell medical insurance? I mean, because this includes life insurance and every other kind of insurance, doesn't it? Or is this just for medical insurance?
Through the chair, this is for insurance, for medical insurance.
Just medical insurance. Thank you.
And I will double check that to make sure that it does not extend to life insurance before we meet.
We're not moving the bill today, by the way, if that puts you at ease, Representative Ledoux. Question?
I'm seeing in the title all sorts of things that don't look like life insurance. I mean,
through the chair, I'm quite sure, but I will double check, but I'm quite sure it does not. It's just for individual, for group insurance. Okay. I think, Section 32. This was a pretty simple change. We changed it from covered individual to policy holders so that everyone on the plan or with a member of the family did not have to get notice of cancellation or coverage change or premium change, but the policy holder himself. Section 33, this extends the definition of a fraudulent insurance act by adding the words or omits information, those three words in paragraph 1 or in paragraph 2 and 3, and adds paragraph 7 as far as defining again what a fraudulent act is. Section 34 is amended to provide for a Class C felony for a fraudulent insurance act and defines what that would be. Section 35.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Culver.
Yeah, I'm just reviewing Section 34. So you said in the sponsor in your sectional, Section 34, last sentence, the current statute does not specify a penalty for these offenses. So you are enumerating what class of felony or what offense by the dollar amount of the infraction?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, the amount of the felony is a little bit further back in the bill.
Okay. And
follow up?
Yeah, I'm just, run me through something here, Mr. Chairman. You've been in the insurance business. So what are the findings of fact to determine whether there's one of the sections deals with kind of going and getting insurance after the fact for an accident to cover something, which would be fraud. Another one is altering an insurance certificate to, and then or selling a policy. Where do we cross the line of what is actual intent to defraud a consumer or another party involved, and what are the findings of fact to arrive at determining that? Because I've seen mistakes where people thought they had insurance, they were paying their premium, they had certificates of insurance issued, and then upon further analysis and review by the industry has gotten very particular about how certificates are written. When they drill into it, finding out that actually the policy may not have been renewed. And so it sets up a situation where somebody could be held liable, but they didn't intend to defraud anybody. It was a mistake. So I'm kind of wondering what the findings of fact and what the circumstances, if we're talking about various felonies occurring with intent to defraud, I need to know a little bit more information rather than gloss over this section, if we could drill into that a little bit.
If it was the producer that made the changes, the insured, well, he wouldn't be an insured if it was fraud, but the person that unknowingly was dealing with him is not going to have any liability. It's going to be upon the person that was committing the fraud, which happens every few years. I think you had one 3 or 4 years ago, didn't you? Where a lot of binders were issued with no policies behind them. And I guess he or she was expecting that there wouldn't be any claims as well. And when the claims came in, that's when I believe the division dropped the hammer.
Through the chair, Representative Culver, I mean, that's exactly right. The consumer himself does not issue certificates of insurance. Mm. The insurance broker does,
right,
or the insurance agent. So if the consumer were giving their client or the contractor they were working for or the owner the certificates of insurance and their broker had given them to them, if the broker had committed the fraud, then the consumer certainly wouldn't, or the customer would not be a part of that act. However, if the consumer had decided he could forge the certificate, you know, do a whiteout and go back in and type, which we've seen.
Add another year.
Then that's an issue where they've intentionally modified the document to show that they've renewed the policy when they know they have not. Then that's a different.
Yeah, so in that case, if the consumer altered the certificate, the consumer would be in violation and subject to fraud charges.
Correct.
Okay.
New question?
Yeah, let's just say So the broker issues a certificate. And for some reason, the broker didn't carry through to renew the policy. The premium been paid to the broker. Didn't follow through with the insurance company, whether it's workers' comp, GL, or other things. Mm-hmm. A situation happens, and a claim comes in, and the insurance company says, your insurance policy's lapsed. You don't have coverage. Where is the consumer in that circumstance? And is there a recovery from the broker? Is there, what happens in that situation? Maybe the broker just made an error, an accounting problem. Is the consumer just out of luck? Is there anything you can recover? Have we seen these things happen?
Through the chair, yes, we have. And it depends. I mean, in some instances, it's an agency agreement, such as State Farm, and State Farm would be responsible for their agents. In a brokerage agreement, the consumer would look to the broker's E&O. But yes, we have seen, and sometimes it is. It's just an innocent mistake.
Yes, question of whether it's intentional or unintentional.
Right, for the findings of fact on the fraud case. So is it E&O insurance? I follow up, Mr. Chairman. Is E&O insurance required of brokers, a bonding limit? What's the consumer protections built into our system?
Through the chair, the brokers are not required to carry E&O insurance.
Okay. So if they had just hypothetically, if there was a large claim against them because they didn't carry out their duty to bind the policy, and then they were sued, they could simply go bankrupt or dissolve their corporation, and the consumer would be left.
Through the chair, that's a possibility.
Okay.
And there is, typically, there is a bond involved.
There is a bond.
It used to be $200,000 for surplus lines workers. I think, has that changed, or is it still?
It's not a significant amount.
Yeah, it used to be $200,000, but Representative Ledoux.
So, aren't brokers agents of the insurance company? So even if there's no E&O insurance, wouldn't you be able to, if the broker or the agent had apparent authority to bind the insurance company, wouldn't that be good as against the insurance company, regardless of whether there's E&O insurance? Wouldn't the binder make the insurance company liable?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, an agent is an agent for the insurance company. A broker is independent and works for the client and is out basically soliciting bids from independent insurance companies, but has no relationship per se with the insurance companies and therefore has no duty or no right to bind the insurance company to that client.
Typically they can't, or oftentimes they can't do it unless they have received either a down payment on a premium finance agreement or received the premium, depending on the company relationship. So if no money has changed hands, depending again on the company and the type of coverage, there is no coverage.
But if money has changed hands and you think that you've gotten insurance and they've issued a binder, wouldn't the binder obligate the insurance company? I mean, they're handing out this paperwork that has binders on it.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that's where the fraud comes in. If the broker, and again, a broker, has taken a consumer's money and has not remitted it and has not had an agreement with an insurance company where the insurance company has accepted the risk and bound the risk, then what you have is a fraud.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. We're getting a lesson on insurance consumer protection. So when you're dealing with, you said, like you named an example of a company that has their own agents, large national insurance company. Mm-hmm. So if you deal with that company and their specific agents, there's a duty by the company to back up the claims made by the agent, even if there was a consumer fraud, versus an independent broker who goes out and binds individual insurance for the consumer.
Through the chair, Representative Culver, there is a difference between being an agent such as a State Farm
or an Allstate and being a broker who represents the client, much to make probably a bad analogy, but most much like a real estate broker, they can go out and shop any house for you, but it doesn't mean that's the one that they have listed themselves, but they can go out and show you any house.
Okay, just to follow up, Mr. Chairman. So if there was a mistake, so coverage wasn't bound, paperwork wasn't completed by the agent representing the national company, would they have, would the national company have a duty to insure as represented by the agent, and we would have good chance of having coverage should an incident happen that was needing, you were needing insurance?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, in most cases, yes.
Well, we've had that circumstance happen in our state as far as somebody dropped the ball and the obligation then?
Through the chair, yes. Representative Culver, yes.
Because this stuff does happen.
Oh. She could tell you horror stories. She probably won't today, but...
Okay, thanks.
There are people that issue, not recently, but have issued policies on non-existent companies. Make up a name, Ajax, Apex. I won't say Alaska Insurance because there is one that's a good company, but please continue. I think we're getting sideways.
Well, Section 25 following on this is amended to require an insurance, an insurer licensee that has reason to believe that an insurance producer which is involved in a violation of 2136, misrepresentation, false advertising, twisting, fraudulent or criminal act, to report it basically to the director so that we can enforce our statutes. Section 36, and this applies to property and casualty, is amended to clarify what is an acceptable effective date of a filing. Section 37 has to do with deviations of the date of a filing for a rating organization. Section 38 is amended to eliminate the requirement that the insurer print the year of adoption on all forms, the policy forms and endorsements as submitted to the division. Section 39 is where we are allowing the insurers, we have already allowed them to post the policies on their internet sites, but we did not clarify that they can also post endorsements. And so we're adding the word endorsement. Section 40 has to do with variable life and variable annuity accounts or policies, and it just talks about the refund amount would be the value of the day that someone decides to surrender that, and it's just clarifying that. Section 41 is, these next few sections are where we're modernizing, adopting standards of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, group model laws for life and health. Section 41 clarifies what constitutes a valid group for issuance of life insurance and gives the director authority to adopt additional requirements by regulation. Section 42 is amended to provide that the section does not apply to certain specified life insurance policies. Section 43 adds a new subsection, may be issued to a group that does not meet one or more of the requirements as defined in that section, E and F of Section 43. Section 44 is amended to allow a health insurer to cover children of a policyholder. This is a compliance with the NAIC, or with the ACA. Our statute said 23, and we're changing it to 25 to comply with the ACA, the federal law. Section 45 is amended to comply again with the Affordable Care Act, and particularly with us being on a health care exchange, the federal, the FFM, that we've talked about when we've talked about the state of the insurance market.
And this has to do with reinstatement. And this will put us so that we're not in conflict with federal law. Section 46 is amending the rate requirements to allow for the division to have proper time to analyze the rates, but also give enough time to give notice to the clients or to the consumers that there may have been a change in the rates. 47 defines healthcare insurance or healthcare exchange. Section 48, this has been a drafting error in statute for a number of years. It should say does not compensate, and it says compensate, so we're correcting that.
Yeah, big difference. And nobody caught it, right?
Yeah. 49 is amending the paragraph. What did I do on 49? 49 is dealing again with association plans and allows a healthcare insurer to decline or cover or may restrict the coverage offered to a self-employed individual under an association plan. Section 50 is again amending the number of days for a rate filing. Section 51 is providing a definition of group health insurance and Section 50.
So this would be an area where we'd have problems with the fictitious groups.
Mm-hmm. Section 51 is giving a definition of the bona fide associations, yes, and this is a non-substantial drafting convention changes made in this also. Section 52, again, group health insurance defined. Section 53 and 54 are, again, dealing with this update to compliance with modernizing group health insurance. And I will tell you that a lot of this was brought about by some of the insurers, MetLife and New York Life, doing business in the state, because our laws were behind. Section 55 is clarifying, again, being in compliance with the ACA, the premiums, how the premium rates may be determined for a small employer as under an ACA, that you cannot use the claims experience. 56 has the meaning of the bona fide association that was given in, well, it gives the definition, it is further back in 97-90. 57 has to do with licensing. 58 is dealing with motor vehicle service contracting, and this is a cleanup of the statute, changing from what then to not later than. Same with 59. Section 60 is a drafting error that is corrected. Section 61 and 62 is simplifying meetings of stockholders for domestic insurers and allowing to meet somewhere besides in this state.
How many domestic insurers do we have at this point?
7. Section 63.
On Section 61, thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Winghart, the domestic insurer, these are people who, rather than principally being licensed out of Wilmington, Delaware, or somewhere, or having a corporate office somewhere, they're centered and based in Alaska?
Through the chair, yes.
And follow up? So why would they want to meet, why would the owners of the board or the partners or whatever it is want to meet in Seattle or somewhere else?
Through the chair, Representative Justin, one of our domestics at this time is actually, their stockholders are out of the UK. So for them to come to Alaska to hold their annual meeting is quite burdensome to them.
Mm-hmm. Like Lloyd's London?
Mm-hmm. Follow up. So what makes that company domestic?
This is where they have registered.
Okay.
Where their home office is.
Sunderland Marine of Alaska is actually domiciled here. Okay. But their stockholders and board of directors are actually in the UK.
Right.
Umalic Insurance Company is actually owned by, their parent is in Minnesota. So their board is actually in Minnesota. So while we're trying to keep them domestic to us, or domiciled in Alaska, mm-hmm. we
but
think
that... Umalic started out as an Alaskan company. It was owned by UIC, I believe, wasn't it?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, it was. But it has sold now to Western National, which is domiciled in Minnesota. They're under that holding company. So we're looking at where they're located, and does it make sense for them to have to come to Alaska for an annual meeting every year simply to satisfy the statute when they could do it telephonically or hold their meeting in Minnesota or in the UK, as long as they hold the meeting and we get the required notice and attendance and minutes.
Okay. Representative Hughes.
Related to that, I'm just curious. Maybe I'm just not thinking, but it says upon approval of the director, and that is you, correct? And just give me a scenario when you might not approve it, and why would it require your approval? I mean, how are you trying to protect the consumer here? Just help me understand that.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, and this would not be my domicile, but just for instance, after what we have been through late last year, earlier this year with MOTA, I may have, if I were the director, I'd probably say they needed to hold their meeting in Alaska this year mm-hmm. if they were domiciled here. If I thought there was reason that they needed to come to Alaska and have an open meeting where people needed to be able to, where we needed to attend or such, then I would ask them to hold their meeting here.
Representative Du.
So we're on Section 61 right now? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So where does that say that the meeting can be telephonic? It's because somebody said something about telephonic.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I take that back. I thought we put in here that it could be telephonic.
And follow up?
Follow up.
Is there any reason why you wouldn't put it there? I mean, is that just a drafting error in the... Did you mean to be allow it to be telephonic?
Apparently not. I thought we did. But I take that back. Apparently that somehow with law we must have gotten that we did not.
Do you want it? I think is what she's asking.
Yeah.
I will say no, because apparently we were overruled at some point with
what? Then my next question is, why wouldn't you want it? It makes eminent sense to me.
I will have an answer for you on that, because I do believe that we, through the chair, that we did discuss that at one point when we were drafting this, as to why it does not say that.
So,
follow.
I'm just wondering. So this is just for stockholders' meetings as opposed to board of directors' meetings?
Correct, through the chair.
And so another follow-up. So how are board meetings? I mean, are board meetings?
This does not, through the chair, this does not address board meetings. This is the stockholders and member meetings.
Representative the bill.
So I see it doesn't address them, but are board meetings allowed to be conducted in other states? And are they allowed to be done telephonically?
Through the chair, I will have to research that and get back to you.
Thank you.
My guess is that portion of 21 was not changed this time. Probably had a more recent update. The bill's not moving today, so we're going to be seeing a lot of Lori in the next few days.
Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
During this, thank you. During this pause, about 12, 15 minutes ago, you used the acronym FFM. What is that?
Through the chair, Representative Joseph, the federally facilitated marketplace,
okay.
healthcare.gov.
Got it.
Section 64, if we're back, is it we're redefining MEWAs or multiple employer welfare arrangements to give the definition of 29 U.S.C. 10.2. Again, it's to bring us into compliance. Section 65, this is where we're getting into the general penalty of a willful violation of Title 21 and taking it from $2,500 to $25,000. Section 66 is adding a new paragraph to give a definition to bona fide association. Section 67 is where we're repealing certain sections of Title 21 that we will readdress in regulation, as is 67 and 68. 69 shows what we're repealing. 70 is allowing for transition regulation. 71 is for a reviser. Instructions and 72 and 73, 74 is showing for effective dates and when the statute would be enacted if passed.
Wow.
Yeah.
It is truly an omnibus bill.
But a shorter one.
A shorter one.
It was a true omnibus bill when it was over 100 pages. And a zero fiscal note, I might add.
Yes.
We're seeing a lot of those now. Representative Culver.
So one committee of referral, it won't be used as a shopping list for somebody on insurance issues, I suppose, at least in the House.
I don't think there's much that will fit into this other than what's...
I don't think so.
Yeah, I was just kind of thinking, Mr. Chairman, that between this and the old tax credits, you turn yourself into a lawyer.
Never wanted to be one. I won't go into that. Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was following along the section analysis, and way back on Section 4, something caught my eye, because the description says... The regulations will that gives you authority to write regulations, and it says that these regulations will be based on model laws developed by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. So are you going to be adopting regulations that aren't based on things that we have in statute and that are just based on model laws? I'm just a little bit confused about how that was described.
The Affordable Care Act allows for three processes. Through the chair, Representative Hughes, the Affordable Care Act allows for three processes, a utilization review, an internal review, and an external review of claims presented. The division has been doing these since the Affordable Care Act was brought, but it's been somewhat of an informal process. We have not had a strict procedure such as the Affordable Care Act affords. The Affordable Care Act itself, the states as a whole did not agree with the process, and the NAIC came up with three model acts: the Utilization Review and Benefit Determination Act, the Uniform Health Carrier External Review Model Act, and the Health Carrier Grievance Procedure Model Act. We're proposing to put these in regulation so that if because this is a process, if the process is not working as well for Alaskans as we hope it does, that it can be tweaked over the next few years.
And follow up?
Follow up.
So anything that you would be putting in those, in state regulations that are based on those three model acts you listed, nothing in those conflicts with our state statutes, is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, no, we do not believe so.
Okay. Representative Colbert.
Yeah, follow up on that. So, little b, line 7, page 4, says the regulations under little a of this section must be at least as restrictive as the Utilization Review and Benefit Determination Model Act. And then it cites another act as well. Mm-hmm. So that's just kind of the parameters on, I think the operative word is as least as restrictive as. But we won't, just clear for the record, we're not going to be referencing national standards in our regulations so that we're, as those regulations change of no act of our own in regulatory process, that we're not referencing a national code in another state. And I've seen that in regulations where other, for boards and commissions have tried to do it. And we've said, no, you need to stick with what we use here in Alaska rather than referencing a standard that will be changing by a national entity. So just clear that that's not the intent. We'll develop our own regs that won't be tied and change automatically with a national group standards.
Through the chair, Representative Kohler, that's exactly the intent, that these will be Alaskan regs based on what works for Alaskan, not a one-size-fits-all.
Okay. Yeah, my only concern, Mr. Chairman, is that we do not link regulation or statute to some national standard that others develop and it changes, so then automatically ours would change with those, and that could be problematic.
Let me give you a lifeline, Lori. I think this is the sixth or seventh time I've been in this position where we've had model legislation from the NAIC. There are a number of benefits that come out of following it, and none of them look like what they did when we got the draft. We modeled it to Alaska, but it helps the consumer. It gives standardization, and more importantly, when it comes time to, if you have a company that's having problems, we have reciprocity as long as the states are all using the same audit procedures, where Lori doesn't have to send a team of auditors to New York or Chicago to the home office of a big insurance company. We can rely on the audits that have been done by the people in the home state because they all meet the same standards, or materially the same standards, and it saved us I don't know how many millions of dollars of not having to send people down. But more importantly, we're getting to the point where a good portion of the policies, you mentioned the certificates, that came out of something called Accord. It's been around for 30 or 40 years where it's standardized intentionally. I mean, you're going to have the same certificate of insurance any place in the country, basically. And it'll have the model number and the year it was issued and everything. But that's to give a standard tool for people that are doing business in more than one state or traveling in more than one state. And ultimately, the goal is to help the people that are buying the insurance. And did I miss anything on that, Lori? Or?
No, Mr. Chairman, you did not. And as these have been adopted since the enactment of the Affordable Care Act, various states that have done it have taken it, statute, regulation, and a combination thereof, which is what we're doing.
And it's, believe me, it's a, we've been joking about the size of this. This is nothing. We had one that was 150, 160 pages, and as I recall, it wasn't amended, was it? Even by Max, who... But any further questions for Lori? Representative Hughes.
Yes, on page 4 of the bill, beginning line 22, it regarding the contract between a, an insurer and a health care provider.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, this is a new addition. I'm just wondering how the medical community, health care provider community is going to be with this, because Of course, they're working on the contract with the insurer, but I'm just hoping it gives the health care provider enough leeway to provide the care they feel appropriate, because it sounds like we're trying to get everything all, a plan all written up and approved, and then the provider would be kind of stuck with that. So is there, I don't know, I don't want the insurance company dictating the care. I want the medical, the health care provider dictating the care, and I'm just concerned a little bit that we might be crossing over where the insurance company is going to be determining the care.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, that's certainly a good question, and we have received a call on it, and we've responded that there's two parts here. There's the relationship between the provider and the patient, and then the insurer and the provider. And we have had part of what we were just discussing as far as the regulation and this new NAIC or the new Affordable Care Act and these grievance procedures, part of it is predetermination of when you go to a provider, being able to know transparency how much the service is going to cost you and what you should be, what your insurance is going to pay. And that's part of what this is addressing, of when you go to, that your provider will tell you based on they have signed a contract with an insurer saying that this is what they've agreed to accept for fee, and that they tell you that if you come to them, this is in network, that this is what you are going to, or they're going to receive, this is what is going to get paid against your bill, so that you don't come out with a huge $5,000, $6,000, you know, $80 bill, whatever. You know what is going to be paid for that service, so you know what your balance bill is going to be. And then it's up to you if you decide to go with that provider or not, but that they declare to you so you know what up front what your charges are going to be yourself.
Well, I appreciate that part of it. I'm more concerned, I guess, with the final phrase, providing services under a treatment plan approved by the health care insurers. There are going to be times when a health care provider realizes what they initially planned out and got approved by the insurers. All of a sudden, there's a situation where quickly they have to change that. And I just don't want to tie the hands of a health care provider, and I'm concerned that the way it's written, it could. Can you assure me that it wouldn't?
I can assure you one thing. We've had ongoing dialogue with AASHNA and the hospitals and the Doctors Association as recently as today, and it will be going on the rest of the week. So they are a stakeholder in this, and they have been participating. And I think if the final work product isn't to what they think it is, we'll see a whole room full of them before the bill leaves.
Okay.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, through the chair, Ms. Winghire. I share Ms. Representative Hughes's concerns, and the definition of utilization review at page 9 sets up a similar set of questions where, you know, you have to ask who's in the driver's seat in terms of the care that would be provided. I mean, I guess I would note that this has been going on for years. You know, you generally can't say we're going to do this procedure because I want to do it. The insurance company has a say in that. That's just the world we're in.
Representative Colbert.
I share Representative Hughes' concerns as well. That
I've got a feeling everybody at the table is on the same page.
Yeah.
I remember the original pitch on ACA. You like your doctor, you can keep them. It's going to be cheaper. And there were a few other. I think I Love You was one of them, too, but I can't remember. There were three or four of them that we haven't quite seen fulfilled. So I think everybody's watching this with a with their eyes wide open.
On that, the president forgot the second part, which was, you can keep him if it complies with the Affordable Care Act. That's what he meant to say. He forgot to say that part.
Can you write his speech?
Yeah, with that, it's 2 minutes to five, and I don't think we have time for the last bill. Thank God that I know the person that was carrying it, and I hope she's not too upset. But
With that, we will hold this bill over and gavel out at 1 minute to 5:00.